our goal and the primary objectives here. First, for some of you, we want to introduce to you the field of vaccine safety, who we are, what we do, how we do it, as well as your role as clinicians in the field of vaccine safety. For others, this course will serve as a refresher. And for all of you, we want to provide updates on vaccine safety initiatives. As many of you know, immunization is one of the most effective health prevention in history. However, vaccine safety has always been an issue since the beginning of time, with the first vaccine dating back to 1798. In the image before you by James Gilray, he depicts in 1802 the intense controversy over the wisdom of inoculating with cowpox for smallpox disease. For the bigger picture, the United States has one of the most sophisticated and comprehensive vaccine safety monitoring programs in the world. There are a number of federal agencies involved in the development and the vaccine safety initiatives. Some of those activities include vaccine research, monitoring licensed vaccines, regulated licensure vaccines, making recommendations about vaccines, administering vaccination programs, providing injury compensation, and the list goes on. The federal government plays a particular role in vaccine safety, and that agency is the Food and Drug Administration. They're involved in the testing of vaccines before they're licensed. First, the vaccines are tested in the laboratory, and then they're tested with computer models. And that is so that we can learn the makeup of the disease and its genetic codes. Secondly, it's tested in animals. And one of the reasons for that is because the animal immune system mimics or is very similar to those of humans. The other reason is tested in animals prior to humans, we have opportunity to see major side effects and if the vaccine will work. And then lastly, we go into human clinical trials, and that's a three-phased approach, and each phase is advanced according to the success of that particular vaccine. This whole process could take up to 10 years or better. Every lot is tested. Every lot must be tested to ensure the safety, the potency, and the purity of the vaccine and the uniformity, that each lot does what the previous lot or the next lot will do. Why each lot is tested? Because vaccines are extremely sensitive. Changes in the temperature during manufacturing could change the potency of a vaccine. Now we're going to have Beth. She's going to share with you about post-licensure and the role of clinicians.
Thank you, Persephone, and it's really an honor to be able to be up here and speaking with all of you today. And we're really looking forward to the discussion portion of this at the end today also. And I wanted to remind you all that in your packet of information, you have a very wonderful CD-ROM, and there's several of the things I'll be discussing in this next section. You will find copies of these things, and I will mention that when it comes in on that CD-ROM. And it has a lot of really great useful information. The CDC is involved in post-licensure monitoring of vaccines to ensure that very rare side effects are detected, which are not always able to be detected in the pre-licensure clinical trials. There are three major efforts by the CDC in post-licensure monitoring that we will review today. There's the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or we call it VAERS for short, which we'll review in some detail. There's the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which we'll briefly review this system and some of its important findings. And there's also the Clinical Immunization Safety Assessment Centers, or CISA, and these activities evaluate new and unusual events, and they also are charged with developing clinical protocols for vaccine safety issues. The Institute of Medicine has also been asked by the CDC to review vaccine safety issues of public interest, and they have published their findings on their website for a number of vaccine safety topics. We will not be discussing their activities today, but you can review their reports by Googling the Institute of Medicine and then just enter vaccine safety and you will see those specific reports. VAERS is a national passive surveillance system co-managed by the CDC and the FDA since 1990. VAERS receives reports of adverse events following vaccination from vaccine manufacturers, private practitioners, state and local public health clinics, vaccinees themselves, or their parents or guardians. The VAERS system receives approximately 20,000 primary reports annually. The primary objective of VAERS is to detect the following four vaccine adverse events: previously unrecognized reactions, increases in known reactions, risk factors for reactions, and reactions associated with specific lots or batches of vaccine. If any of these events are detected, then VAERS serves as a trigger for further clinical, epidemiologic, or lab studies. While VAERS attempts to detect various types of vaccine adverse events, in reality, a number of other types of events are also reported to VAERS that are not associated with vaccines but are due to other causes. Let's review the broader categories of VAERS reports. First, there are actual vaccines, side effects, or the adverse events that are associated with vaccines. Second, there are vaccine-potentiated events, which are precipitated by the vaccine. For example, a high fever may cause an infant to experience a seizure. So the vaccine may have caused the fever, and the fever in turn may cause a febrile seizure, and so that's known as a vaccine-potentiated adverse event. Third, there are programmatic errors, which may be reported errors in vaccine preparation, handling, or administration. And finally, there are coincidental events, which are unrelated to vaccination but occur around the same time as vaccination. VAERS casts a broad net, encouraging the reporting of any adverse events following any vaccine. And we tell providers that if they're unsure about whether an event should be reported, that they should just go ahead and make out the report. And I know you all have a lot of time to do that, don't you? But we do really appreciate that when you do make the reports, and it is important in order for VAERS to work effectively. VAERS reports, this is a slide that is showing, describing the categories of VAERS reports by severity of the adverse event. The vast majority of reports are considered to be non-serious reports, about 85% of the total number. About 15% are considered to be serious reports. These include adverse events that result in life-threatening illness, hospitalization, prolonging a prior hospitalization, or permanent disability. There are about 200 deaths per year that are reported to VAERS. The Institute of Medicine has reviewed a large series of these deaths reported after immunization and has found the vast majority of these reports cannot be attributed to vaccination. Acknowledgement letters are sent out to all reporters. There is an automated letter generation system where missing key information is also solicited in the letter. In serious cases, medical records, autopsy reports are obtained. Deaths receive special FDA follow-up and case investigation. Those cases in which the reporter has indicated that the vaccine has not recovered, there is a 60-day and a one-year follow-up that is conducted. Okay, so what are some of the strengths of VAERS? It's national in scope, and because of this, VAERS can detect very rare adverse events, because in the preclinical trials, you may only be dealing with 10,000, 20,000 people when you're looking at vaccine safety, but once it's released on the market, VAERS takes all reports, and the vaccine's being given to millions of people. So very rare, that one in a million side effect that you can't see in the pre-licensure trials, VAERS can detect it because of all of you out there giving us VAERS reports, but we can look at these reports coming in on a much broader basis. The system has timely reporting for new vaccines and serious events. VAERS reports are sent and reviewed on a weekly basis, and in some cases, even on a daily basis. The system generates signals or hypotheses that lead to further investigations by scientists. Another strength of theirs is that for a national surveillance system, it's relatively inexpensive to operate. Some of the weaknesses of VAERS is that, as you all know, the vaccine schedule is very complex. You're all giving many different shots at the same time, multiple vaccines, and there's multiple events. There's a mix of causal and coincidental events that are reported to the system. There are also statistical limitations to VAERS. VAERS does not measure how many vaccines were given, so the denominator is unknown, and rates of adverse events cannot be accurately calculated. Also, not all vaccine side effects are reported to VAERS. Not all reports are verifiable, and some might be sent in without adequate identifying information, so they are impossible to confirm or follow up. VAERS also has an inability to determine vaccine causality without additional studies. These weaknesses in VAERS can best be demonstrated by this 2x2 table. This is what we use in epidemiology. This type of table is commonly used to calculate odds ratios and is helpful in determining statistical associations. To determine an odds ratio to link vaccination and subsequent illness, one needs data for each of the four boxes appearing on this slide. But VAERS only provides data for square A. And even the data for the square A provided by VAERS is not complete. Therefore, methods besides VAERS surveillance are required to provide the data for the other squares, which then can demonstrate whether a link between a vaccine and an adverse event is causal or coincidental. So you can kind of see that there, the illness or the syndrome at the top and vaccination on the side. Sometimes these graphs are kind of hard to really read, but you do need scientific evidence in each one of those four squares, and our surveillance system really is only filling box A, and even that, it's not all the way complete. Perhaps one of the biggest areas of confusion about the VAERS system is that people do not understand what the definition is of a vaccine adverse event. A vaccine adverse event does not mean the vaccine caused the adverse health event. Vaccine adverse event means that the health event occurred around the time of vaccination and may or may not be caused by the vaccine. And that's probably one of the biggest misunderstandings that we get all of the time. And so we wanted to re-emphasize it on this slide for all of you. The Vaccine Safety Data Link is a collaborative effort between CDC and 8 healthcare organizations in the United States. There's a total of approximately 6 to 7 million, I think it's like 6.8 or almost 7 million members, 2.5% of the U.S. population. Advantages of this type of approach to studying vaccine safety issues are that it's a large population with computerized, linkable administrative databases, which are a powerful tool for providing active surveillance data to establish causality. Unlike VAERS, which requires someone to complete and send a report, the Vaccine Safety Data Link automatically collects information and vaccination about adverse and vaccination and adverse events directly from the patient's medical records. And so it's an active surveillance system. And VAERS is a passive surveillance system. So this, because it's active and doesn't require someone to fill out a report, it's much more powerful. And also because it links it directly with the medical records. But even the VSD has limitations because VAERS is collecting reports from everyone in the U.S., and this is the VSD, it was only on the about 2.5% of the United States. So some of the signals that we see in VAERS, VSD can study more in depth. So the systems kind of work together. These are some selected findings from the VSD, and many of you may have remembered a few years ago, Rota Shield vaccination, VAERS picked up a signal when we saw increased cases of intussusception, and for those of you who are not medical professionals out there, that's a folding over of the bowel, kind of a bowel obstruction after the old Rota Shield vaccine, and we saw an increased risk for that, about 1 in 10,000. Well, there's a new, as you all know, there's a new Rotatec vaccination that's on the market now, and rotavirus vaccination called Rotatec. And so VSD took a look at this again just to say, okay, let's just see what we can see about it with intussusception, and they found it was not associated with an increased risk for intussusception. Also, They've recently found, too, with measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, that it is given in the second year of life that there seems to be an association with an increased risk of immune thrombocytopenia. And that was another finding that they had. Another system that looks at vaccine safety or is helping with vaccine safety, assess vaccine safety adverse events, is the Clinical Immunization Safety Assessment Centers. The goals of CISA are to develop and disseminate clinical protocols for the evaluation and management of adverse events, improve understanding of adverse events, pathophysiology, and immunology at the individual patient level, identify genetic or risk factors that may predispose groups to certain reactions, and provide expert advice for supervised immunization and clarify valid contraindications for re-immunization in high-risk groups. Another activity that is at CDC is the Brighton Collaboration. How many of you came to the session this morning on vaccine safety? Okay, there's a few of you who did. Jane Gadudu spoke at length about the Brighton Collaboration. It was formed in the fall of 2000 to develop case definitions for adverse events following vaccination. The collaboration has an international membership of volunteer participants with backgrounds in patient care, academic research, public health, vaccine clinical trials, and regulatory or manufacturing issues. Over the past 8 years, Brighton has completed a total of 22 case definitions for use in surveillance and researchers, which can be downloaded freely on their website. And this is so that everybody is talking apples and apples instead of apples and oranges. So when we're wanting to know what a researcher who's looking at high fever, what do they mean by high fever? And so these types of definitions can give those researchers who are researching vaccine safety adverse events the same language or the same understanding so that the research can be better comparable. And that's why this activity is so important. Okay, next, knowing that many of you are clinicians out there, we wanted to include a few slides, and many of you could probably tell us a few things, too. And we're really looking forward to talking with you more later and after the session, so please feel free to come up to any of us. But let's talk a little bit about vaccine management. It is a clinician's role to assure proper vaccine storage and handling. The manufacturer is obligated to maintain proper environmental controls during shipping of vaccines. But it's the vaccine provider's obligation to ensure that the vaccine stock maintains its safety and effectiveness. Vaccines should be checked for proper condition on arrival. They should be stored under proper conditions, whether it be refrigeration or freezing or light protection. Providers should know the proper instructions for reconstituting the vaccine, either how much to dilute it and whether it needs to be shaken or how they should mix it, shelf life after reconstitution, and rotate the stock so that the shortest dated vaccines are used first. Timing and spacing. There are no contraindications to simultaneous administration of vaccines except for cholera and yellow fever, which should be given about 3 weeks apart. Other administration issues, a new needle and syringe are required for each vaccine given. And interestingly, many of you may have read some reports in the Northeast, there was a physician's office that was reusing the syringes. Do any of you remember that story? We've actually, over the years, heard a lot of that occurring, and it surprises me every time I read about it that people are not using a new syringe and needle with giving vaccination. Proper needle length and gauge for each vaccine prevents unnecessary local, neural, and vascular or tissue injury. Injection site recommendations can be found in the general vaccine recommendations and also the CDC toolkit for storage and handling of vaccines. And there's a new one that's coming out. It's 2008, and they were hoping to have it ready by the time of the conference, but apparently, and they were going to stick it in your in all of our packets, but apparently it's not out quite yet, but it will be on the CDC website, and you can get the most updated storage and handling. How many of you have not heard of vaccine information statements? Can I see a show of hands? Is there anyone in here who has never heard of that? That is wonderful. That is great. Vaccine information statements contain vaccine safety, as you know, vaccine safety information, including vaccine risks. And public health requires that all healthcare providers who administer childhood vaccines provide the CDC vaccine information statement to patients and or parents for each vaccine administered. The healthcare provider should record in the patient's permanent medical record the date the vaccine was given, the manufacturer's lot number, and the provider's name and address, and report to VAERS any adverse health events following immunization. Special populations need careful assessment in order to determine if the vaccine administration is appropriate, especially for people with moderate or severe illness or weakened immune systems, such as bone marrow transplant recipients, HIV-infected persons, persons with conditions that cause immune system deficits. People who have had a severe allergic or anaphylactic reaction to a vaccine in the past should not receive additional doses of the vaccine. Live vaccines are usually contraindicated for pregnant women, and they're also contraindicated for recent recipients of antibody-containing blood products. When is it really safe to immunize? This is a slide that's kind of depicting a lot of times when healthcare providers are not immunizing because they're feeling like this, it may not be safe. And all these conditions listed on this slide, it's okay, including a family history of any vaccine adverse events and a sibling or whatever. And so it's our right to immunize for all of these things, disease exposure, mild illness, most allergies, unless it's anaphylactic, like I said. So vaccine reactions fall in three categories. I've actually added a fourth, which is an emotional category at the end, but that's not technically in the books. You'll see it, you know, the way we talk about it as the first three. The local reactions generally are the least severe and frequent, such as pain, swelling, redness at the injection site. Local reactions may occur in 50% of vaccine doses, depending on the type of vaccine. Systemic reactions are more generalized events and include fever and malaise, muscle pain, myalgias, headache, loss of appetite, and others. Allergic reactions can be caused by the vaccine antigen itself or some other component for the vaccine, such as the cell culture, the stabilizer, preservatives, antibiotics used to inhibit bacterial growth. Providers should also remember that injections can cause an emotional response in some individuals. And I love this picture. Our EIS officer about 5 years ago went to, I think it was Korea, and was participating in one of their vaccine clinics there and took this picture of these young adolescent girls receiving immunization. And appropriate measures should be taken to decrease fear and pain during these types of clinics. So vaccine reactions, what can you do? React to the patient's needs and provide physical and emotional support. Refer patients as appropriate to specialists and evaluate and treat any problems they may have. Refer patients who are looking for more information to reputable information sources like the CDC Public Inquiry Number or the Immunization Action Coalition. Reassure them that they did the right thing and that most vaccine side effects do not reoccur with the exception of allergic reactions. Report vaccine adverse reactions, especially those that are unusual or severe, to the vaccine adverse event reporting system. When possible, follow up with persons who believe that they have had a side effect to assure appropriate resolution and that their questions are addressed. And refer people who believe that they have been injured by a vaccine to the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And as you probably all know, on the back of the vaccine information statement, there's contact information for the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program and also for VAERS. And in your disc that you have all received, there's also a copy of the VAERS form that you can get out of one of the appendices on the disc. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Levine, Nancy Levine, who's going to talk to you a little bit about some hot topics in vaccine safety.
Thanks, Beth. I'm Nancy Levine, and this is the first time I've been at an NIC conference. It's a wonderful conference, and I'm glad to be here with you today. The segment that I'm going to be talking about is some of the current or emerging issues in vaccine safety. These are some of the things that I deal with on a daily basis in my office, and many of us are working on a lot of these issues. Beth and Perstephany have told you CDC is actively committed to assuring that the vaccines in this country are safe and effective. CDC devotes considerable resources in people and funding to making sure that the vaccines are safe. In this part of the presentation, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about mercury in vaccines, vaccines in autism, vaccine combinations and multiple vaccines at the same time, Rotatec and intussusception, and HRSA's vaccine injury compensation program. Okay, mercury and vaccines. Thimerosal is a was used today in multi dose vials of certain vaccines, but it's a preservative, and it was used to prevent contamination. And preservatives are not required in single dose vials. In 1999, the United States Public Health Agencies, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and vaccine manufacturers agreed that thimerosal should be eliminated from most vaccines. This was done as a precautionary measure, and since 2001, all vaccines routinely recommended for children 6 years or younger and marketed in the United States do not have any thimerosal or only very small trace amounts, with the exception of inactivated influenza vaccines. There is no evidence that there is harm that is done to anyone from mercury found in vaccines. There is also no evidence to date to suggest that thimerosal in vaccines causes any health problems in children or adults beyond local reactions at the injection sites, such as redness or swelling. The evidence also does not support a causal relationship between exposure to thimerosal in vaccines and neuropsychological disorders of autism, ADHD, and speech or language delay. Autism and vaccines. Many of us at CDC are parents, and we share the concern of many people in this country about the number of children with autism. And we are very committed to better understanding what causes autism and how it can be prevented and how it can be recognized as early as possible. But there is no evidence, as I said before, that any vaccine or vaccine additive increases the risk of developing autism or any behavioral disorder. In 2004, the Institute of Medicine conducted a scientific review of all existing studies and concluded that there is no association between autism and MMR vaccine or vaccines that contain thimerosal as a preservative. The CDC supports the IOM conclusion in this. CDC is works every day with national organizations and other federal agencies in the government to try to better understand what causes autism, the frequency and the trends in autism. We have research that searches for the causes and effective interventions and improving early detection and diagnosis. Okay. Another question that comes up quite often is, can vaccines overload the immune system? Specifically, can multiple vaccines given at one time or combination vaccines overload the immune system? There is no evidence that giving multiple vaccines at the same time is harmful. Multiple vaccines work with the immune system to boost our immunity, and it does not work against the immune system to overload it. There are many advantages, as you know, to giving combination vaccines, and we do see these combination vaccines certainly as the wave of the future in that they reduce patient discomfort and overall costs. As Beth talked a little bit about intussusception and Rotatec, Rotatec is a vaccine. It's really the only vaccine we have in the United States for the prevention of rotavirus disease. Rotatec was licensed for use in 2006, and it remains the best way we have to protect children against rotavirus disease. Rotavirus is a virus that is responsible in the United States on an annual basis for approximately 400,000 doctor visits, more than 200,000 emergency room visits, 55 to 70,000 hospitalizations, and between 20 to 60 deaths. In developing countries, rotavirus is a major cause of childhood deaths, estimated to cause more than 500,000 deaths in children less than 5 years of age each year. Intussusception, as you know, is a serious life-threatening condition that occurs when the intestine or bowel becomes blocked. With prompt detection and treatment, almost all patients recover fully. The CDC and the FDA encourage you as healthcare providers to report any cases of intussusception and any other serious adverse events to VAERS as quickly as possible. A question that comes up very often from clinicians also, is this the same vaccine that was taken off the market in 1999 for causing intussusception? No, this is a different vaccine. That was RotaShield. It was removed from the market because we did find more than our baseline expected numbers of intussusception, but we have not found that with Rotatec. Excellent. The HRSA Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. The Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was established to ensure and establish an effective and efficient forum for individuals found to be injured by certain vaccines. The Injury Compensation Program is what we would call a no-fault alternative to the traditional tort system for resolving vaccine injury claims, and it provides compensation to people found to be injured by certain vaccines. CDC is not a part of the Vaccine Injury Prevention, Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. The three federal agencies that are involved in this program are the Health Resources Services Administration, that is part of HHS, HRSA, the United States Department of Justice, and the United States Court of Federal Claims. No court has conceded that there has been a link between vaccination and autism. And I know that there was a case that you all probably heard about and read about that came before HRSA, but I do need to point out that this case is still an active case. We really don't know and can't really, we don't really know all the facts of this case, nor can they tell us a whole lot about this case. But we have been directing people to HRSA with their questions to the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program for any questions they might have about the case or the program or the Omnibus Autism Legal Proceedings, which are going to be going on in Washington in May. Okay, I'm gonna turn over for Stephanie.
Thank you, Nancy. Finally, and just as important as everything else we've discussed so far, risk communications. How do we communicate, discuss, or talk about the benefits and the risk of vaccines? Risk communications is an important component of childhood immunization. However, it can be difficult at best to understand the risks of preventable vaccine diseases when we do not get to see or experience in large numbers the negative impact of not being vaccinated. In the following slides, we will look at several factors that have been studied to help us better understand risk. The primary goal of risk communication is to educate and inform, to improve the decision-making process, and to help eliminate and reduce the fear of risk. Secondly, is to build and regain trust. This is done by sharing vaccine information statements, talking with the parent or the guardian prior to vaccination, as well as asking if they have any questions. One of the things that I like about the present day dentistry practice, whenever I go to the dentist and I get a root canal or a crown or something that's traumatic or something that I perceive as being traumatic, my dentist, she'll call me the night of the visit to check on me, see how I'm doing, or she'll call me the next day. And what that does, again, that helps for me to build trust, and it builds trust in her, me, and it also, when she tells me how much it's going to cost, I believe she's not gouging me. So, but again, just taking that extra step to follow up after vaccination with a parent will help build trust when those issues that come up in the that you see in the media, when you hear that from a clinician and one that you've been going to on a regular basis, you believe in what they're saying versus what different things, stories you may hear or read. And lastly, achieve consensus. Again, by eliminating the fear and reducing the fear, you can achieve agreement and consensus.
Thank you.
Now this slide, this is the second time you've seen this slide, and the reason I really wanted to show it again is because the research has shown that people really want to know. They really want to know the benefits and the risks. They want to know what they should do, what they can expect, and how can they prepare for the risk. Research published in 2001, led by Dr. Terry Davis, showed that 4 out of 7 questions that parents had concerning vaccines are vaccine safety related questions. They're highlighted in orange on the screen, and I'll just read those questions to you aloud. Is there any reason I should not give my child this shot or these shots? What side effects could my child have? What should I do if my child has any side effects? What should I do if my child has a severe side effect? 2 of the 4 questions that parents had were, what should I do if my child has a side effect? The answer is twofold. First, address the medical issue. Secondly, report any side effects to the VAERS Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. It is through VAERS is how we continue our monitoring of this is how we monitor adverse events associated with vaccine and determine if there is a need for a label change, change in usage, update the vaccine information statements, or conduct additional research. At this time, I like to open the floor. At this time, I'd like to open the floor for questions and turn on the mic, and if you will, please ask us. If we don't know, we'll take notes, and I'll get back with you. Thank you.
Also, copies of this presentation will be posted on the National Immunization website.
Okay.
And you'll be able to get the, if you're interested in copies of it. Any questions?
Oh, my goodness.
If you have any questions, please come to the mic.
Hi.
We've been getting questions about aluminum. Now the thimerosal has died down.
Yeah, what kind of questions have you been getting?
Well, you know that now aluminum is the bad actor and not thimerosal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a substituting one for another, but I don't know, you didn't address it, so I was just wondering what your thoughts are.
We have some studies taking a look at aluminum hydroxide, which is found in many vaccines, or in some vaccines, and we do know that the aluminum hydroxide can increase local reactions and pain with injections. And there are some researchers that are looking at aluminum hydroxide and different questions that might be associated with that. But we do not have any scientific evidence to say, or even suggested, or even any hypothesis that it could cause aluminum hydroxide is causing any kind of severe systemic side effects. But the research to date has shown that it is associated with minor side effects, mainly local reactions. Are there other questions?
So often we think of it as parents that have questions about vaccine safety, but it was interesting in a survey that we did of rural docs in Oregon, 25% of our rural clinicians had concerns about the safety of vaccines. And so that was, so if we've got a fair number of clinicians that have got concerns about the safety of vaccines, it makes a tough go. And we're trying to learn a little bit more about that. Certainly the rotavirus experience didn't help that. That was one thing that had come out. And then another statement was, you know, I don't like to use things that are brand new. So the new vaccines, oftentimes you'll see a delayed uptake in any of the new recommended vaccines because they want to see that they're safe and have been in use for a while. And I just was wondering what your experience has been.
Well, I'm interested, too, in your experience. Was there any specific thing that they were, in the research that you did, that you found that the physicians were most concerned about in your research?
You know, they, again, it. I think a lot of physicians are, you know, I think some of maybe this reflecting the role of a skeptical scientist, you know, saying, mm-hmm. you know, I got to see that it's been around for a while and safe before I do it. So that was the issue with the new vaccines. And you know, they again, the you know, the one thing that came, autism didn't come out much, but the rotavirus experience when we did this was right around the time of the intussusception and the rotavirus, and that seemed to be in interviews with them the thing that they commented about pretty uniformly.
And is there things that your program is planning to do in order to address the concerns of the physicians, or at this point in time, or is there?
You know, that's a really good question. I work with the state immunization program. They do a great job of mm-hmm. getting information out there, and it's just a matter of continuing to educate our clinician population about it and just keeping at it and letting them know, like you said, it's a different vaccine now, and it's not having the same sort of reaction. But once burned, they kind of tend to be a little reluctant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there has been a number of studies that have looked at attitudes and beliefs about physicians and nurses, but I haven't seen anything in the real recent literature. I know there was some that were done with military providers, I think it was like in 2002. And one of the, you know, we've talked in our program that it's going to be as vaccines, and we see, as healthcare providers like yourselves, see fewer and fewer of these vaccine-preventable diseases anymore, and the same thing with the parents, it's naturally going to be a question that people are going to have, okay, well, what's the vaccine doing? And so the risk perception about vaccines and vaccine safety becomes more important over time as people see less and less. So it's something that we all need to be in tune with as far as the latest vaccine safety controversy or things that people are hearing about, but it's also understanding how we, and this is one of the reasons for this course too, so that to give you a background a little bit about how we do monitor the safety. And we're on, you know, when something is happening, you can bet there's not just CDC that's on top of it, but everyone is jumping on if there's any finding at all with safety, because the realization is that we want to make sure that the vaccines are as safe as possible. We're giving them to well people, and no one wants to, you know, we all want to be on top of anything that may be a signal for a new rare adverse effect from vaccines. But thank you for your question. Appreciate that. Yes.
You mentioned a new CD that will be available soon. You said a CD, was it? Or?
Yeah, in your bag there is a CD-ROM,
right.
And it has a number of wonderful resources on it. And there's a pink book. How many of you have heard of the vaccine preparedness? Okay, some of you have. Thank you, Chris. It looks like this. Christine just shared hers, and I should have dug mine out. But it has the pink book on it, which has a chapter on vaccine safety in it. And there's also appendices in the back about storage and handling issues, and it also has the VAERS form in it for completing that. And there is a new toolkit for 2008 on vaccine administration and storage issues that people were hoping it would be ready in time for the conference, but it is not ready for the conference, and so you're going to need to check on our website. And so if you go to the cdc.gov website, you'll find, and if you put in vaccine storage and handling or vaccine administration, you'll see that 2008 toolkit. And I think it's going to be up sometime shortly after the conference. Do you happen to know, Chris? You know, I've heard that it's going to be just a couple weeks after this conference. You should see it on our website. But the old one, I don't think, is on there right now, but you can find it on the Immunization Action Coalition website has it posted, the old toolkit.
Okay. One of my assignments was to bring back as many CDs or whatever that I can for our physicians. Is that possible? Or?
There is, and I'm not sure, there is, you could call the CDC information line and ask them about ordering. You can just refer them to the website, which has most of the materials that are on this. Chris Sheedy is with the National Center for Respiratory Diseases and Infectious Disease. Okay. Yeah, she doesn't work directly in the. Is there anybody here from the Training and Education Branch for vaccines in the audience? Just curious. They're the people who, you know. Oh, where? Okay. Yeah. Oh, hey, Betty. Can you fill us in a little bit about the question was whether people can get extra copies of the CD-ROM here, and then there was another question about the toolkit when that might be ready. Can you come to the mic so everyone can hear you, please? Thank you.
For the immunization works, there may be some extra copies at the exhibit area when that opens, so you might go to the booth downstairs and see. And other than that, we have a publications website on the CDC immunization and vaccines and immunizations, and you can go to the publication website and put in, there's an order form, and you can just go in and put in your order. The vaccine storage and handling toolkit, they've been working diligently on that, and it should be out very, very soon. And you can also order that from the website. And then it is also supposed to be online. So you can go in, there's a URL that will just take you right to the toolkit, and you can just get it, you know, download the information. It's a very comprehensive, really very good resource for everybody.
Yeah, thank you so mm-hmm. much.
I just wanted to make a comment about the comment about intussusception and Rotatec. There was an MMWR that was published on March 16, 2007, and that was we had done a post-licensure monitoring of intussusception after Rotatec vaccination from February 1st, 06 to February 15, 07, and that is on the CDC website, and it does have really important information about what we found and how important it is for clinicians to submit VAERS reports for anything that they see. But so I would direct you to that on our website as well. You can get that electronically.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Cook from Mary Bridge Children's Hospital in Tacoma. And as you guys were talking about vaccine safety and people concerned about safety, I was thinking about my experience with people, and my experience is that people who are concerned about vaccines are not necessarily concerned about other safety things for their children. And I mean, often they're eating Cheetos and God knows what is in those. I mean, some are, but frequently the other issues like helmets and like even just the safety of Tylenol are not often their concerns. And I'm wondering if anybody has looked into, or in your research, do you have any insights about why it would be that people are so concerned about vaccines and not other safety issues?
Yes, thank you so much for that question. And, you know, there's been some wonderful work by Carol Chess, Peter Sandman, and who's the other guy? Anyway, but they have done a risk perception chart, and usually in the last, we didn't put it in the course this year, but it kind of shows you on people's risk perception, how, and it's a wonderful chart, on how people perceive risk. And the incident you were talking about is kind of, well, why is somebody not worried about, you know, the Tylenol risk of, you know, something happening with their child? And one of the things on their chart shows that people's risk perception changes when it's something that they choose. So if it's something that it's a voluntary or involuntary thing, a lot of people see immunizations as being involuntary, in that they're being made to have their child vaccinated for school, you know, for instance, and it's not really their choice. And so it moves them to the risk perception of being more risky versus if the choice was really, you know, I want my child to have this Tylenol type of thing. And so there's a number of things that move people's risk perception, and vaccines unfortunately fall, and I'm sorry I don't have this chart to show you because I think we took the backup slides off this particular one, but it's very interesting, and I thank you for that question. Are there other questions that people have? Don't be shy. And we can learn from your experiences too, all of us. I've learned a lot from people through the years, and so it's always interesting to hear what you're hearing as well.
Hi, my name is Erica Carter. I'm from Fort Eustis, Virginia. I work in a clinic in the military community where we have a lot of parents who lose their children's shot records. So my question is if you have a child, say that they're at the age of 7, at what point do you restart a vaccination series, or you just assume that they've had vaccinations? Do you draw titers? I see someone shaking their head.
Yeah, I can see several people who probably have the direct answer, and I can tell you that none of us that are sitting up here are actually daily giving vaccines, and so that is a wonderful question, but I bet there's someone here in the audience who might have the answer for that one. I don't want to tell you something wrong, but, oh, right over here, okay, yeah. Can you come to the microphone so everyone can hear you? And I'm sure there's several of you up here.
Correct. And then my other part of the question is how do you know about the spacing? Right. We normally restart, but I just wanted to make sure that that's what we do.
I just want to say something else when you came up here about Army people losing your records.
Did I say it out loud?
Because it's very difficult to get records from the Army, and we have been very fortunate, and we've also been working year to year. So we have our local Army base, Air Force base, and Navy. They have all put their databases into our child profile, into the Washington State Registry. Wow. They have shared all their information with us. So I'm here to tell you that if you're persistent, even with the Army, they
Thank you.
I just had a quick question. I work in health communications. My question is about the MMRV, the combination vaccine with the new VIS that was just issued.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if there's a plan, since MMR always seems to be the bad guy with thimerosal before, and now that there's concern that maybe there's a connection with the additional seizure when it's given in the combo vax. And I was just wondering if there was a plan that once the number of vaccines are, you know, we're back up to, we can start doing the MMRVs again, you know, when the demands, we're able to meet that demand. What's the plan? Because now, will we see a lot of people separate those, you think? Or what are you guys thinking on that?
There's no, the ACIP, you know, took a look at this. This is the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, and there are, and also the Food and Drug Administration, and there's no preference for giving MMR plus V or MMRV. The research did show that there was a slight increased risk of seizures, febrile seizures, following the MMRV, but it's such a slight difference. And, you know, there's risks with everything, and it's just such a slight, the bottom line is that there is no preference being stated for MMR plus V or MMRV. And I think that's...
I'll take this last question.
Just a quick question. With the Hurricane Katrina, we were talking about missing vaccines. Now, you can reason based on the age that they left, what they may or may not have, but if they're never turning up anything, is there a plan out there for people who permanently relocated to different cities about the child's record?
Yeah, now that's not quite a vaccine safety question. It's a great question, I know, but...